we are so, so lucky to have Emmanuel Welch, AKA the French detective. And I just love this. So we're going to get into your story, but we're going to start with a quick little speed round. And I'm interested to hear your answers. So when you hear the word fraud, what do you think of?
Fun.
Oh my God, that's such a good answer. I think that might be my best answer ever. So, okay. When you hear the word ethics, what do you think of?
Necessary.
Oh, that's a good one too. And then finally, who makes better embezzlers, men or women?
Women.
Oh, why do you say that?
I think they, I mean, you do know more about it than I do, but I think they are really good at looking innocent, right? Like they're never suspected of anything. I mean, they can blend in better and be, you know, in the background, not be noticed and be discreet, and people assume nothing is going on.
But never underestimate Gladys.
Yes, Gladys.
Okay, so for the people who don't know you in the fraudish audience, Manuel, why don't you talk about how you got to where you are, which is the French detective?
The French detective. So I come from journalism. So it's not an uncommon background nowadays. You have more and more women who are private investigators, and more investigators who used to be journalists. So they transition sometimes out of necessity because of, you know, the media landscape has changed in the past 20 years, but also because it's a natural fit. I mean, when you're a reporter, you love asking questions, you're curious, you know how to pick up the phone, how to knock on doors, how to ask questions, how to poke, ask for more, look for records, archives. So I think it's a natural fit. I mean, in my experience, if you can work when you're a former reporter, you can work with a former law enforcement detective. That's the best. We really complete each other. We have different skills, different traits, personality traits. Sometimes that's my ideal combo: working with a former law enforcement friend on cases. But yeah.
Well, and then your language abilities obviously help you.
I'm still learning English, but I'm a native. So I'm French. I was born in France, grew up in Lyon. And it's true that I love working on international cases involving French. So involving maybe Canadians or French nationals or nationals from Africa who grew up speaking French. So yeah, this can really help on international cases. I worked on cases, you know, involving a Russian oligarch who had money and contacts in Switzerland. So that came in handy, you know, to do research on his real estate holdings in Geneva or things like that.
Yeah. And the journalist background, I'm going to say, as former law enforcement myself, my writing skills are probably not anywhere close to your writing skills.
It's funny. I was talking to a former homicide detective friend who's now a PI, and he says, you know, your reports, they read like a romance novels, the way you describe things. And these reports are very, very terse, like very straight to the point. My reports, it's true, I tend to tell a story a little bit more because of my, you know, journalistic background, perhaps, but also when I work on an insurance case, you know, someone who fakes disability and is actually doing fine, like lifting weights or, digging a pool in his yard. I like to tell the story a little bit, to show where he's at, what's his situation, does he have a wife, does he have children, what is he trying to do, so that when they sit down with him, for a settlement or to tell him, we know what you're up to. They know more about him. I like to give more information than necessary sometimes, especially when lawyers need to settle or to negotiate something before going to court.
You know, everyone talks about being able to be a storyteller, and like, we don't flower the facts or anything like that. But I worked a case where I told the lawyer, like, all the different parties and their sort of rationale for why they would or wouldn't settle. And that ended up being the settling, was that they had such an aversion to money, like writing a check, but they didn't have an aversion to giving something that they didn't feel such ownership of. And if you don't do those backgrounds and you don't kind of give them the story of them, it's harder. They just become like a person with no, you know, depth.
Yes, not exactly. And I really like, no matter what, a lot of cases involve looking at my subject, my person of interest, but also looking at all the family members who try to understand their situation. Why are they doing this? Sometimes I do research for, let's say, a real estate developer who's buying an old building, and they need, you know, the tenants out, so they're going to offer a settlement. So they want to have more information about the tenants and say, hey, we just bought the building. Would you be interested in being relocated, or we give you money and you move somewhere? And, you know, it's very important to find out if the tenants were actually on their way out of New York. They wanted to leave New York. They have a house in Florida, they like hunting upstate, or all of this information counts for sitting down with them. And I usually work with developers who are actually very human, who also like the storytelling part of the reports, because then they sit down, they know more about the person, and they can, you know, have a conversation and hopefully offer a settlement that makes everyone happy.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's negotiation.
Information is power, you know, all this, you know, PIs in their signature and their emails, like, information is power. Yes, exactly. And it's also, information is good. I'd rather have more information than not enough in life, you know?
Oh, yeah. Information is definitely power. That is for sure. So, which goes to Emmanuel, I actually met in person. I believe it was the first or the second Osmosis that we finally met in person.
The first editions of Osmosis were, it was in Las Vegas and then in Disneyland in California. Yes, we met at Disneyland. That's what we did.
Yeah. And it's been a wonderful, like, friendship the whole entire time. And I love that your journalist background, and you just posted, you went to the FOIA conference in Chicago, and I have a link in the show notes to your post about that. So talk to us. I don't think I've ever had a FOIA expert, and I consider you to be pretty expert there.
Oh, I can suggest some to you after the show. But yeah, FOIA, it's funny. It's really funny to end up in a room at a FOIA conference with everyone just like thrilled and excited to talk about FOIAs, because, you know, it doesn't sound too exciting to a lot of people. You tell them, oh, I'm going to a conference on Freedom of Information Act requests. It's like, really? That sounds great. But actually, everyone in the room at this conference in Chicago, and it's not the first edition, like, it's been going on for a long time, but it was the first back in person since COVID. Everyone was just so thrilled, and I love geeking, you know, about with people talk about FOIAs you know, coming from Europe, from France, where very few records are public record. I love any type of public record in the U.S. I adore, because we don't have this in Europe. A few things are more public than in the US. I would say corporate records and maybe tax records. When you talk about Scandinavia, you can pick up the phone and know how much someone pays in taxes with the Swedish tax office, for instance. But FOIAs are, I wouldn't say they're underused in a way, because some people abuse it. They were talking at the conference about FOIA abusers. For political reasons, they want to flood agencies with requests. I didn't know about that so much. But yeah, FOIA is a great tool that investigators can use to obtain information that can be relevant to a fraud case, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. Like when I was with Customs, we had a person in charge of the FOIA request. She actually had a legal background, but there's a wealth of information. But as I was looking and reading your summary of it, people give up. Don't you think people give up? And they know people will give up.
They know. So that's the thing, you have to be persistent. The panelists at the conference were all really amazing people. And journalists, it was a conference for journalists. So I think that there are not many investigators, but we tagged along with my friend. And the main advice was like, don't give up. So when you start your request, your FOIA journey, just know you're in for the long haul, that nothing will be easy. So just be in the right mindset that you won't give up. Never file, 5 days before. Don't expect them to respect the deadline of 5 days, depending on your state. Usually it's 5 days. Only in Florida, I see that they respect the deadlines, actually. Florida
Oh,
is
that's
amazing.
fun.
Oh, Florida is like paradise on earth for FOIA. I love it. I love it. And they're
Oh.
nice. They're amazing. Yeah. Not everywhere, but many agencies, amazing. Not New York State, definitely. So be persistent, prepare a while before you need the information, because, they're going to either deny you or ask for an extension or take an extension without, asking you first. And they had a lot of other advice. Like they said, pick up the phone before filing a FOIA and try to talk to the FOIA officer. And it's just a very good advice, because we're investigators, so we can figure out the direct line or the phone trip maybe more easily than the general public. But yeah, pick up the phone, talk to the FOIA officer and say, hey, I'm going to send a request. I don't want you to hate me. How can I make it more to the point, so that it's easier for you to find the relevant piece of information, the relevant document that may contain what I'm looking for? And speak to, on a human to human, a sort of be nice, be fun. Their job is stressful. Not many people call at the end. They're on email all day, so that really makes a difference. That's what they notice. And also, you don't know what you don't know. So if you call, you may learn that the document that you're looking for may be held by another agency, or that you can ask for two different documents that may contain information. That's talking is actually younger people may not be so used to pick up the phone, but talking to humans is a wealth of information. That's how you learn a lot.
Oh yeah, I mean, I would say that a lot of times we're asking for too much when they're like, you really need to drill it down.
Narrow it down. Don't ask for too much, because it's too easy for them to deny you, saying, it's like a burden. Yeah, there's an expression that it's a burden for them, so they deny you. They shut you down. And also, yeah, a lot of, in many cases, several agencies may have the same information, or it's good for you to try at the other agency as well, because you never know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I will have it in the show notes, but you had an article, you were the highlight of an article in The Guardian, Gadgets, Drug Mules, and a French Accent, My Life as a Private Investigator. I love this article. I'm going to put it in the show notes, but there's a quote about palm trees. And this is just like, it was like the French embezzlers love palm trees and fast cars. So do they all land in Florida?
There was a time when they were... All my social media research was leading to Florida. It was amazing. And I had this case with this young embezzler who was living the high life, the good life in Miami, while his boss back in France was just like trying to, trying to make the French law enforcement interested in his case, because he had lost a large amount of money that this kid had stolen. And he was the kid that started a business in Florida and was living the life. Yeah, palm trees, the French love California or Florida, just because it's the fantasy life for, French person thinks of the US in that, you have a large avenue, cars and palm trees. They don't want to go to Boston. It looks too much like Europe.
Yeah. Well, and we think that about like the south of France. So there was a there was a big Ponzi scheme in Seattle, and he ended up, I believe, in the south of France, and they caught him. And this is going to lead to our next section. They caught him because of his dogs.
Oh, I was working on a case recently involving an American fugitive who also got located because of his dogs. I don't know if it's the same, but he and his wife had dogs that they really, really liked. And finding the vet in the small town for the dogs was how he was located.
Yeah. Like, we're always kind of taught, look at the extended family members. But one of my things is dogs, because who goes to a veterinarian and doesn't give your real phone number because they have to contact you, your email, my vet does, and address? Like, you're not going to falsify your address for your vet because you don't think about that. But then when you register your dog, you know, you have to have your dog registered in the county.
Yeah, so, I call, and some agencies are transparent and they even have a website. Like in New York, you can see by zip code if there is a dog called Bichon or, I don't know, Ramses, or you don't have the address, but it gives you a sense. If the dog's name is really rare and linked to a zip code, it's like, oh, maybe my person is, you know, in this zip code, in that borough of you know, in Manhattan or in the Bronx. So, yeah, and you can call the agency, you know, the... there's a famous scent investigator. The trick is, like, she calls the county, the dog registration office, and say, "Oh, I got bitten by a dog, and I think their name is," and they give the name of the dogs, and then she can check the address of the person. And you can do a lot of pretext calls with the dogs.
Yeah. So I don't think we have ever talked about dogs on Fraudish before. This might be a first. But I mean, so this goes to open source intelligence. And
yeah,
Emmanuel is very good at it.
Oh, I try to be, but it keeps changing. You need to adapt. But that, yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, again, we've always been taught, look at the kids. But in this episode, we're telling you to look at dogs.
Yeah, look at dogs. And actually, you know, that's interesting. You know how we use more and more facial recognition softwares to, it really helps me in my OSINT investigations, but they can't really do the same with dogs. I would love a software that could help me, you know, find the same dog in photos online or in social media profiles.
We may have a business here, Emmanuel.
No, I think it's possible using some like Python programs or like with picture of the dogs that you analyze. There is a platform called Hugging Face where you have lots of AI scripts, and they may have something on how to recognize dogs. I don't know. They have everything.
Wait, what's it called? Hugging Face?
Hugging Face.
Ooh, I have not heard of that.
It's a library of programs where you can, that investigators and anyone can use. A lot of them are free AI programs where you can. There's a program like that, and I can send you the link for the show notes, how to create a very convincing AI-generated profile photo. You know, we used to, years ago, you used to maybe purchase, photos from, how do you call them?
They were like stock photos.
Yeah, stock photos. And then it became stupid because, you know, everyone can do a reverse image search. So then you started creating AI-generated photos, but they looked fake. But now you can do it much better by melting two photos of two real people together and following some instructions, like regarding the eyes. And you can make it a very convincing profile photo for your sock puppet accounts. Sock puppet accounts, which are basically working social media accounts, you know, if your clients authorize you to use sock puppet accounts, you can create some with AI generated profile photos.
Well, I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, the Hard Fork podcast, and it's two tech guys, Kevin Roos and Casey Newton, and they actually were doing like, is it AI generated or not? And I mean, they did not do well. Let's just say they could not tell the real from the fake.
It's getting better and better. Yeah, exactly. There's a tell-all. It's about how the eyes look. And yeah, this program is really a way to solve that problem.
Yeah. So I love fraud in pop culture. And one of my favorite TV series is Lupin. Have you watched Lupin?
No, not yet, but everyone tells me it's good. I don't watch much TV, unfortunately. I can't find the time.
Oh, you must watch it. Just the whole French thing. You must watch it. It's so good. It yeah, is so good. So do you have any other, you say you don't watch much TV, but is there any like movie or podcast or book that you really enjoy that is kind of about our world of fraud and all that?
Book about the world of fraud or a podcast. No, I was a big fan, of course, like a lot of people, the Mike Basil podcast, which was so interesting, even though the privacy part, I kind of gave up on it a little bit just because it complicated my life so much to try to stay private. But yeah, not podcast wise. Yeah, I'm blanking right now. That's exactly what it's not working.
You're too busy to listen to podcasts.
No, I do, but not so much on investigations. Well, there's the Matt Spire. Matt, yes. Spire, who's the president of the New York State Association of Private Investigators, is a very rare investigator, is also an entrepreneur and is really efficient at it. And he has a podcast where he invites a lot of people. And I used to really like the Austin Curious podcast, which was really for Austin nerds. But Matt Spire invites a very wide variety of PIs. So it's a very interesting, his podcast is a very interesting repository of interviews with PIs. That are very very good, but yeah, you know, it's exactly the type of questions. If you give me 5 minutes, I could find, I could tell you who I'm listening to, because like,
but I always have to pull out my phone and see what I've listened to lately.
Yeah, that's a problem.
I have a couple that I listen to all the time, no matter what. Tuesday and Fridays are my kind of big podcast days, so. I want to say you're kind of a generalist, but you're not, because you have the journalism background and also you have the French. So,
it's interesting. Some PI specialized in all, they only do, you know, they only do background checks, or they only do fraud investigations or personal injury investigations. And it's true. I like to stay diversified. It's more, it's one way to stay current on a lot of topics. And I think Austin's skills can really be applied to so many different investigations, not the same skills. So that's what I like, to stay nimble. And also it's fun, because if I were doing due diligence investigations all day, it would be probably more lucrative, because you can be more efficient at it, and you know, have a very well-oiled machine and invoice and have repeat clients. But yeah, in my case, I'm maybe that's why I'm not such a good businesswoman, but I really enjoy what I do. Every morning I'm like so happy to work and to take in new cases. So that's the trade-off, definitely.
Well, and you're in New York, so like there is a ton of work in New York. Being in Bend, there's not a ton, but there is work. but New York is kind of the epicenter of so much.
New York as a type for investigators, the bread and butter of a lot of investigators is real estate investigations, because real estate rules New York in a way. So you have all the financial investigations, but real estate is a huge subcategory. You have illegal sublets, and because you have this rent control situation where you have rent stabilized apartments that are you know, the golden egg, everyone wants it. So there is a sort of underground market of rent stabilized apartments that are, rented out, subletted out illegally, turned into illegal offices. So management companies and real estate owners are in need of investigations all the time because of all the fraud going on at this level. So real estate is probably a very New York thing for investigators here. And I would say 60% of my cases are real estate.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's a high number. But I mean, we all need somewhere to work, live, sleep, eat, and it's property.
And here it's like everyone's obsession all the time because you have so many renters and the rents are so crazy high. A lot of people spend, 60, 70% of their income on rents. This is absurd. It's too much. So there's a lot at stake with lodging and property and what you do with property and also the hustling in New York City, trying to survive with like three, roommates and subletting here and there, subletting your apartment while you live in North Carolina, and work remotely, things like that. So this is interesting. Lots of workplace investigations, I would say, as well, and general frauds. Like it's interesting. I contract with mid-size investigative agencies, and they do the due diligence for a hedge fund, but they also take the personal cases for the hedge fund founder who has some personal issues with maybe a girlfriend or maybe their children. Someone is getting married. They want to check the future son-in-law or things like that. So it can turn into a variety of cases just based on these relationships that, high net worth individuals hire a firm to work on their corporate cases for their company, but they also need the same firm to help them with a lot of personal matters. So it's interesting. These firms have personal relationships with the powerful in New York City.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so we hope to see each other in October, maybe at Osmosis, we're hoping. What is one thing that you can leave the audience with that like maybe has surprised you since COVID?
Surprised me with COVID. I would say that COVID was really good for OSINT in the sense that people were back online a lot, turning their Facebook public again or TikToking a lot. I still find some interesting videos of people who are stuck at home, people, on disability who were recording videos with their kids. And it's really helping my disability cases and my workers' comp cases. So there was a wealth of activity because of COVID and people ordering stuff online. So their digital trail grew tremendously. So I would say COVID has changed that in the sense that everyone's digital trail has increased. And also people working from home makes it more difficult in some cases too, because there are, friends who do a lot of surveillance work in New York, which I don't do. I'm more like a desktop investigator. And people don't leave their house sometimes all day, so that's complicated. And they gave up, maybe they sold their car, so you can't even follow them anymore in the car. So COVID has changed the lifestyle, definitely, and a lot of fraud that took place when people were too idle at home, definitely. And we're still working with cases like that. I just got a call today from the victim of a Bitcoin fraud who, we're still dealing with the aftermath of all this activity that grew during COVID when people changed their habits, definitely.
Yeah, the changing of habits. Like, I mean, COVID was terrible, awful, especially in New York. I mean, my sister-in-law lives in New York, and I would call her during COVID, and you would hear the ambulances just nonstop in the background. But people don't have to go into work, and butt in seat 40 hours a week. And I think that's good for people. But at the same time, I don't know.
It has changed the city center, definitely. And New York is, thank God the tourists are back, but the lack of the workers not returning to the office as much as we had hoped is still an issue with the midtown in Manhattan that used to be much more lively with, you know, it's really terrible for businesses. For investigators, it means that you need to be aware of all of that. So it's good to read the news, no matter what. It's good to read newspapers every day and be aware of how society changes, the new apps they're using, how they've they delegate work, they order more. Some things they order that you were not aware people could order. Now people order their meds much more. The fraud is changing with all these, interactions that used to be uncommon before COVID and now very common.
Well, thank you so much, Emmanuel. I appreciate this. And I love seeing what you did. The FOIA request, or conference that you went to, when I saw that, it just, as investigators, we need to not just take our state licensing courses. We need to really be broad in our training.
And you know, there is a general trend that I noticed myself with COVID and not. Like COVID, for me, I've noticed that the data is being really, really mixed up because there is a wealth of data coming from a lot of sources. So the databases that we subscribe to as investigators, I think that the data has become more mingled. And so I find myself going back more to public records that are material that I can hold in my hand. So I find myself going to agencies and putting records myself so that I have the real thing without any confusion. Like I go back to voter registration records, to DMV records. I file a lot of requests for the real paper documents that I receive in the mail so that I know for sure that this address really was linked to that person at a particular time and not trust the database. So if it's something that has changed since COVID, I find myself more eager to go back to good old, musty public records.
Yeah, no, they're gold. They are definitely gold. So thank you, Emmanuel. And I want to see you in October.
I would love to see you. I can't wait.